I'm David Nelson. This is second in a series this week on Latin America, especially on how we can learn from our brothers and sisters in Latin America. I spent 8 years in Brazil. I was a pastor of the Evangelical Church of the Lutheran Confession in Brazil. And today I continue to relate to Brazil and to that church on behalf of the American Lutheran Church and its Division for World Mission and Interchurch Cooperation. That means, in short, I get to visit Brazil a couple of times a year, which I dearly love to do since I can no longer live there. Before we begin, I'd like to show you this book, The Cry of My People, subtitled Out of Captivity in Latin America, written by Esther and Mortimer Arias. Esther and Mortimer Arias are Uruguayans who worked with the Methodist Church in Bolivia. As a matter of fact, he was a bishop of the Methodist Church in Bolivia. Because of political persecution, he was forced to flee from Bolivia in one of the more recent coups, not the last one because there's been one since, and he is now teaching in California. This is a very good book. It's available in the bookstore. I ask that the bookstore have some copies available for those of you who are following this series. You will find it complimentary and helpful to understand Latin America and the cry of the people. Please do not confuse this book with another book written by an author, Penny LaRue, called The Cry of the People, also about Latin America by a journalist, but a different book. This one is published by Friendship Press and is a recent book. The author is Esther and Mortimer Arias, and let me spell that last word, A-R-I-A-S. We mentioned in the presentation yesterday a Colombian sociologist and author, Germán Arciniegas, who suggests considering the Americas as one continent, linked together not only by the name Americas, but also by a common history in many parts, by many similarities in the racial makeup of the people, and by the aspirations of the people. The four divisions of this one continent, according to Germán Arciniegas, are, number one, the Hispano-Indian America. Number two, the Portuguese America. Number three, the English America. And number four, the Anglo-French America. These divisions correspond very closely to the following groupings of countries or countries. Number one, the Hispano-Indian America corresponds to the 20 or so republics, Spanish-speaking in, for the most part, that spread across Latin America from Mexico and Cuba in the north to Argentina and Chile in the south. The second category, Portuguese America, corresponds to the nation of Brazil. And the third category is the United States of America, English-speaking America, and Anglo-French being Canada. To us, these four Americas, let me quote now from Mr. Germán Arciniegas. To us, these four Americas are four great provinces of a continental mass, moving along their separate paths in search of the same thing, freedom. Freedom has been a theme of our own nation for over 200 years. We fought to obtain it. We fought to extend it to all. We fought to preserve freedom from those who threatened it, and we like to say we are prepared to fight again if necessary to maintain our freedom. We should therefore not be surprised if all the peoples of the Americas and those other provinces as well have similar aspirations. Brazil is a nation which achieved political independence from Portugal in 1822. At the time, the political power was named the Empire of Portugal and Brazil. And this empire spread from not only Brazil in Latin America, South America, but also to Africa and to Asia. The son of the emperor in Portugal, with seat in Lisbon, the viceroy of Brazil, declared independence from his father and the crown and the empire. His name, the leader who declared independence and became, therefore, the first ruler of Brazil, which was initially also an empire, Dom Pedro II. Brazil remained an empire for another 50 years, achieving its status as a republic, free and independent republic, rather than only a independent Brazil, in the year 1872. As you would imagine from this capsulized history, the Portuguese influence in Brazil was very strong, since the Portuguese colonizers and missionaries were from Brazil, but has remained strong even since the Declaration of Independence and even since the establishment of the Republic. Portuguese and Brazil to the present day enjoy a special relationship with one another, and their citizens enjoy a special relationship. Citizens of either country may work in either country without work permits, without passports, without immigration quotas, and there are very few barriers to trade between the two nations. So the ties between Portugal and Brazil have continued strong, partly because of the language. Portuguese is the language of Brazil, as well as Portugal and a few other countries in Africa, and also in Macau in Asia. But the relationships are fraternal and have remained strong even in the area of commerce. As you might expect also, having been colonized by Portugal, Brazil was rather quickly brought into the Roman Catholic faith. The conquerors, the conquistadores, forced their rule on the new land and its indigenous population, and the Catholic missionaries likewise arrived to bring the land and the people under the sovereignty of God and Christ's vicar on earth, the Pope. The cultural, political, economic, and religious domination of the people therefore began almost simultaneously. And it has taken centuries for the church to recognize how closely it was bound to this European domination. Only in recent years in Brazil has the voice of the Roman Catholic Church been heard for those people who have been under domination. It is a pleasure to be able to say that today the Roman Catholic Church is in a new era and is rapidly achieving worldwide recognition as the voice of the voiceless, as a critical voice against inhuman and oppressing structures of government. And instead of a theology of domination and an emphasis on doctrine, the Roman Catholic Church in Brazil has made a significant contribution to what is generally regarded and called liberation theology, and an emphasis on the experience of the gospel in the daily lives of the people, especially the poor, who are throughout Latin America in the majority. Now, it is not only the Roman Catholic Church in Brazil which has had its eyes open to the need to preach the fullness of the gospel of Christ, taking into consideration the reality of the people and the context of this preaching. Also, the Evangelical Church of the Lutheran Confession in Brazil, a sister church of the American Lutheran Church and the Lutheran Church in America, has in the last 5 years surprised many in the worldwide Lutheran family with a maturing understanding of its role and mission to the Brazilian people, and also surprised them with their courage in the stand that they have taken on the political and social issues of the day in Brazil. This is the same church which 10 or 12 years ago was in some circles being criticized for too close an identification with the revolutionary military government which had taken power in Brazil in 1964 and which continues in power to the present day. As you remember, an LWF, a Lutheran World Federation assembly, was planned for the Porto Alegre, Brazil, in 1970. It was never held there. Some thought that the Evangelical Church of the Lutheran Confession in Brazil was not speaking out adequately against the imprisonment and even torture of those who opposed the government. Today, I'm also happy to be able to say that if it were ever true, it is no longer true. The circumstances around that LWF assembly are very complicated, and we won't go into it. But today, especially in the last 5 years, this church has established priorities for its action, which include evangelization, the introduction of a more equitable contribution of the members towards the work of the mission and the mission of the church, but also they have specifically mentioned agrarian reform and legal rights for the indigenous population as being among their priorities. Well, I wanted to spend just a few minutes to give this introduction. I have some other things prepared. I certainly want to make this an informal and encourage you to ask questions when you'd like to. I'm going to move to now, unless there would be some specific questions about something I've said, because a more general question possibly would better come later. But if there's some specific question about this brief introduction, we could handle that now. Yes?
You said that the Evangelical Lutheran Church is doing quite well there in Brazil. I was wondering, how is it relating, and what percentage of population are becoming members of it? And what types of actions are they doing politically, like you're talking about?
Okay, the Brazilian, the Evangelical Church of the Lutheran Confession in Brazil is a church of about 800,000 baptized members. It is not a small church according to Latin America standards, for the Protestants in Latin America are usually smaller in number than this church, although some Pentecostal groups are bigger. And their growth in the past has been very comparable with the population growth rate. They have had a strong German influence. That's not the only influence they've had, but like some of our Lutheran groups in the U.S., there was a stronger German influence. And the first German Lutheran settlers in Brazil were quite content to stay within their own community and to minister to the needs, both physical and spiritual needs, of the people who had already identified themselves with this Lutheran community. But also, I think as the development of the country opened up new areas, and as the people, the generations went by, now we have a completely different situation. And this Brazilian church not only considers itself Brazilian, but is very insistent that it be called a Brazilian church, which it is. There is limited use of the German language in a few congregations that still consider this essential for some of the German-speaking people who either are there temporarily from Germany, or in some cases in some isolated areas where the German language has continued, even though they may be native-born Brazilians. And they are opening to the Brazilian society in a fresh way. They are going into areas of Brazil where they have never been before, even if maybe the first impulse for that movement was because some of their members had gone there ahead of them. They have gone in not only to minister to their own, but also in a fully integrated way to minister to all the people in all their needs. So that in the Amazon region, where a lot of settlement is going on, this church sends on not only a pastor to found a congregation, but teams of 3 and 4 persons, one of whom would be a pastor, another one whom would be a nurse, another one of whom would be an agriculturalist, and another whom might be a teacher, into areas where the government has not yet established the infrastructure that is needed for that area, where there is misery, where there is a lack of concern for the indigenous population in the area on the part of the settlers and has been ministering to these situations. It is not a fast-growing church like some of the Pentecostal churches of Latin America, but it is a serious church who is concerned about its growth, but wants it to be according to its understanding of the mission of the church and the principles and the priorities which has chosen. That's all I'll say just now about that church, but we can come back to it later. Any other questions?
Is there cooperation with the Protestant Church and the Roman Catholic Church as to the needs of people and the abuses of the government?
Yes. Especially, I can say that for the churches, the Roman Catholic Church, this Lutheran Church I mentioned, the Methodists, and the Episcopal Church. There is another Lutheran group which is not associated and does not meet regularly in this fellowship of churches. But these four churches exchange observers at all their major functions, which is perhaps even unique for such a dominant Roman Catholic Church, that they invite in these Protestant observers and they let them participate on their committees. And when they speak to a political or an ethical question on to the government, they usually speak with one voice. They do not speak individually, but they put themselves on the line alongside one another. I have one question here. The Pentecostal churches are have differing approaches. There are those who remain aloof from the everyday political realities and would say that the church has no business, there is no political dimension to the gospel, and therefore we will not say anything, thereby undergirding the status quo. But there, interestingly enough, in Brazil there are Pentecostal churches who are members of the World Council of Churches and who are as active in this active in the social realm as any of the other churches, and they say that if you think that Pentecostal church means leaving the world, you're mistaken. And so we have some examples of that in Brazil, especially a church called Brasil para Cristo, Brazil for Christ. And in the city of São Paulo, this is one of the member churches of the World Council of Churches. They have exemplary work. Question here.
What about the changes in Catholicism? I have an impression that maybe this was more oppressive than helpful in many of the Latin American countries. Is this something that recently come like which?
Well, since Vatican II, there have been a lot of changes in the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America, as other places in the world, but not everywhere. There are many Latin American countries where the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church is among the most conservative of the world. Colombia is an example. Mexico is another. But in Brazil, we have a very progressive hierarchy. I wouldn't say that all the bishops are on the side of this progressive wing, because that's not true. But they seem to be in control. Their presiding bishop of the Brazilian Bishops' Conference is Cardinal Evaristo Arns, and he is kind of generally recognized as being the successor to Dom Helder Câmara from Recife, who has kind of achieved an elder statesman status because of his age and is simply not as active in the ecclesiastical politics of the Brazilian church. But Cardinal Arns is a very courageous spokesman and very progressive, and occasionally will be mentioned as, you know, a candidate for the papacy because of his understanding of the role of the church and his willingness to put the church into the life of the people. So in Brazil, you have a little bit of a tension that exists between the two wings. And when Pope Paul, John Paul II visited Brazil in July of 1980, a year after he had been in Mexico to the Puebla Bishops' Conference, the two sides in Brazil were pulling on him. They each wanted him to say something that would fit in with their understanding, and they thought, and each of the sides thought that they would get the Pope to declare himself on their side, because the Pope in Puebla had not really been so clear as to his commitment to the poor in Latin America. But the Pope was brilliant in Brazil. He said all the right things. He satisfied both sides, and he is acclaimed a liberation theologian by the progressive hierarchy, and he is considered a faithful pope by the conservative hierarchy. Now, how he did it, I don't know. You can pick and choose from his statements in Brazil, and you'll find exactly what you want to find. It was really amazing. So, whatever you think of the pope, I was impressed by his ability to walk that narrow line without falling in. And that's what he wanted to do, obviously, and he was well prepared for it. I believe we'll move on to some of these things that I want to say about the Brazilian reality. I think the word needs a little explanation. It's in Portuguese, it says everything. A realidade brasileira. We have a Brazilian girl here with us today who knows exactly what that means, and if we could include her, it would have been nice. But let me try to explain it. It really is a way of saying everything that happens that's important, and is of vital concern to every Brazilian. That is the Brazilian reality. It might be positive, it might be negative. Another word you might use would be the context, but the word reality carries with it such dynamic understanding, that it makes you sit up and take note whenever you hear it. Somebody's going to say something important now because they're talking about the Brazilian reality. And of course, it's not only Brazilian reality. The Spanish uses the same word, so that it is the Latin American reality is really what we're trying to convey through these series of presentations. This is, as I mentioned, the most favorite phrase of observers, of Brazilians, of Latin Americans, the Brazilian reality. Now, the most favorite phrase of observers who come to Brazil and want to try to, in a nutshell, explain what is Brazil to someone who hasn't been there, they like to use the word the land of contrasts. The land of contrasts. I'm not going to go in and rehearse all those contrasts for you. If you want to read the September edition of the Reader's Digest, you will discover specifically an article about Brazil where all those contrasts are spelled out. The one contrast that I would like to mention is the phrase, a rich nation of many poor people. A rich nation of many poor people. This isn't my phrase. I don't know where it came from. But it does say a lot, because Brazil is a land of promise, a land of future, a land of riches. But it would be a mistake to understand Brazil as only that. Because if we include all the regions of Brazil, especially if we include the northeast of Brazil and the north generally, we find poverty, we find unemployment, we find distress and misery on the human level that matches most of the rest of Latin America. It goes without saying that in the south, you will find a Brazil where those people still might live on the fringe of the city, but where you would feel very comfortable and very much at home, and you're as a tourist with luxury hotels and restaurants, where there's a substantial middle class of maybe a third to 40%, and besides the elitist, so there is that contrast. Now, a president of Brazil put it even better. His name was President Medici, and in an unusual candid answer to a question that was raised, the question being, how is Brazil faring? How is Brazil getting along? He replied, the nation is doing very fine, thank you. The people are doing very poorly. He recognized the situation, the reality in his own country. And even though he was not known as a very sympathetic president to the social needs of his people, he was not blind. I would like to just mention a few of the issues that face not us here looking at Brazil, but Brazilians. What are Brazilians talking about? When they get together at a retreat center or over a cup of coffee or in their homes or in the office, what do they talk about? What are the issues that are burning for them? What do they reflect on when they ask the question of where is our country going? And what is our Christian faith have to say about these issues of our day. Well, I don't know if it's possible to divide up these things into categories, but I had to because there were so many. So I've chosen to speak in the areas of the political arena and the economical sector and then the social and religious sector, just to kind of get them into some workable framework. But I certainly didn't, and I'm not suggesting that they are exclusively for these areas. The number one problem, the number one issue on the coffee table everywhere in Brazil is inflation. Is it any different than the United States? Well, the difference is, as I mentioned yesterday, when they talk about the high rate of inflation reaching 10%, you say, well, that's all right, we got 10% too. Yeah, but they're talking 10% a month and you're talking 10% a year. That's the inflation that Brazil has at the present time. Now, you say, how do they survive? Well, some survive very well and some make a lot of money. Others are really going downhill fast. But there is a way that the inflation rate has, in the laws of the land, interest rate is, the banks, it may not reach the high inflation rate, but it, you know, it's better than half, maybe two-thirds of the way. Rent contracts and any kind of contracts always take the unpredictability of inflation into consideration. There are ways, you know, to survive, but it is a problem that Brazil has to solve or it will lose its battle for greatness. Inflation, the cause of inflation, I'm not an economist. I don't know if I want to talk about why the inflation rate in Brazil is so much higher than it would be here. But it certainly is related to the fact that that Brazil has been living on borrowed money for a long time. The Brazilian miracle of the 60s, which was to achieve an annual GNP rate of increase of over 10% for a whole decade, was achieved largely through investments from abroad, from borrowing from the international banks and from the investments by corporations. They have to pay that money back, and they're paying the interest and part of the principal on it now at the rate of $8.5 billion a year. And their export trade is only $14 billion a year, and that says nothing about the petroleum that they need to import, which is substantial because they have very limited petroleum sources. The $55 billion is the recognized foreign national debt for Brazil, the highest in the world, and one of the finance ministers threw everybody into a tither when he said, it's not too much, because whenever our foreign debt becomes too much, then we won't be able to borrow any more money, and then we'll know we've reached our limit. That was, of course, that finance minister didn't stick around very long. He lost out soon. But it's true that the foreign bankers are committed to investing in Brazil, and they will bail themselves out year after year after year because they cannot afford to let Brazil go under. And they really believe, and I do too, that if Brazil licks some of its problems, it will become a rather powerful nation of the 21st century and perfectly capable of returning a good investment, if not a high investment, on whatever you want to invest. Another area that's on the discussion table in Brazil is something in Portuguese called abertura. This means the opening up of the democratization process, which was initiated a few years ago. I said that the revolution of 1964 is still in power. It was a military revolution. It overthrew a democratically elected government. It said when it came into power that it would return the power to the people at when the time was appropriate and when the people were equipped and mature enough to have that responsibility. The Brazilians have gone through many difficult years. There have been years of harassment, imprisonment, even torture. Fortunately, those days are past. A limited amnesty has resulted in releasing political prisoners. Torture has been eliminated, except on some spontaneous local level that is not under the control of the government. And a return to elections at the local and state level has occurred. There is not yet the full return to a presidential election that is being promised for some years in the future, and it's still not decided when that shall be.